This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. Before the show starts, I'd like to ask you to consider subscribing to News from Science. You've heard from some of our editors on here, David Grimm, Mike Price. They handle the latest scientific news with accuracy and good cheer, which is pretty amazing considering it can sometimes be over 20 articles a week. And you hear from our journalists. They're all over the world writing on every topic under the sun, and they come on here to share their stories. The money from subscriptions, which is about 50 cents a week, goes directly to supporting nonprofit science journalism, tracking science policy, our investigations, international news, and yes, when we find out new mummy secrets, we report on that too. Support nonprofit science journalism with your subscription at science.org/news. Scroll down and click subscribe on the right side. That's science.org/news. Click subscribe. This is a science podcast for July 1st, 2022. I'm Sarah Crespi. Each week, we discuss research and news from science and the sister journals. First up, we have online news editor David Grimm. We're going to talk about a change of heart for the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. For decades, the group caused controversy on the high seas, and now they're turning their patrolling ships into research vessels. After that, producer Megan Cantwell and researcher Emily Brodsky, they're going to discuss data from this massive eruption in Tonga, January 2022. The blast from this underwater volcano sent shockwaves through the air, water, and land around the world. In the 70s, 80s, and 90s, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society caused some controversy out there on the ocean until a change of heart. They're now turning what some people once called pirate ships into research ships. Online news editor David Grimm is here to talk about the surprising transition. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Sarah.
I think we should start with the before times, with some of the more controversial projects of this group. What was Sea Shepherd up to in the early decades?
The Sea Shepherd Conservation Society started in 1977. And for, as you alluded to, Sarah, for more than three decades, they, depending on who you talk to, they were either saviors of the seas or terrorists of the seas. But basically, they had a few ships. And what they would do was they would harass whalers and people that were overfishing. They claimed to have sunk a few whaling ships. They basically got in a lot of people's faces on the high seas in the name of conservation, but they were also a pretty colorful organization. The leader, Paul Watson, he sort of wore a captain's uniform and holstered a knife, and a lot of these ships ran up the skull and crossbones. And so they really acted like pirates and actually were even labeled as pirates by some international courts. Anybody who's seen the series Whale Wars, which actually documented a lot of their exploits, can get some sort of sense of the types of things that they were doing for those decades.
And some people say this was what should have been done, and other people say it was bad for the movement, right?
Sea Shepherd says that they protected a lot of animals and saved countless species, but a lot of critics said that, especially by sinking whaling ships, all they did was bolster pro-whaling sentiment in those countries, because all of a sudden you had this foreign organization coming in and trying to tell them what to do, and maybe people that were on the fence about whaling all of a sudden become much more pro-whaling. At least that's what critics have said, that everything that Sea Shepherd did in the past has largely backfired because of how the sentiment has changed in some of these countries against what they, I think, were hoping for.
Well, what about these days? Things have changed. They're no longer the rule breakers they once were. What made them change their ways?
Well, Paul Watson stepped away from the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society in 2014, and that really allowed the organization to rebrand itself. Somebody new named Pritam Singh came in. He's a wealthy property developer and environmentalist, and he came in with this idea of, you know, we still want to be a conservation group, but can we really use science to lead us forward? You know, and in other words, his concern and the concern of other scientists that sort of came on board the organization was, if we're going to protect these species, we have to know how many of them are out there, and we have to know whether our efforts or the efforts by others are actually bearing fruit.
So if you're going to ask questions like that, you're going to need a baseline and you're going to need observations to see if things are changing off the baseline. Do they have enough ships or enough people to do the kind of monitoring that you're talking about?
Well, that's one really big advantage they bring to the table. So they currently have about 12 ships on the water. I mean, it sounds like a lot, but actually there aren't a ton of ships available, even in sort of well-off countries like the US, in terms of ships available to academics. First of all, it can take a really long time to get on a ship. It could take 5 years of grant writing, and then it can be very expensive. And with its 12 ships that are largely run by volunteers, Sea Shepherd sort of promises a cheaper, faster way for scientists to get on vessels in the first place, whether that means they're studying endangered species or maybe taking salinity levels, you know, measuring things that maybe climate change is impacting the oceans. And one of the things they can really offer that nobody else seems to be able to do is they have agreements with several Latin American countries, for example, that actually allow them to board fishing vessels. And what this allows them to do is actually get on board these ships that some suspect are illegally fishing or overfishing, and actually determine if that's true. You know, how many species are these ships catching? How many fish are they catching? What kind of gear that they're catching? And a lot of this stuff has to just been sort of guesstimated by scientists in the past. This has been really hard data to collect. Some people call them ghost ships, you know, these ships that people really don't know much about. Like, what are they doing out there? Maybe satellites can tell you how many of the ships are out there, but they really can't tell you what these ships are actually taking in. And Sea Shepherd at least promises to be able to do that.
They have these agreements. And the reason they have the agreements is because what they help patrol the seas. This is not research exactly.
Well, so right. A lot of these agreements are agreements with these countries to basically help them patrol their own waters. A lot of times these are countries that are in the developing world, which don't necessarily have the ships or the resources to patrol their waters, to protect themselves from these sorts of illegal fishing, or even to get the data on illegal fishing. And so Sea Shepherd inks these agreements with these countries saying, we'll help you do that. And in conjunction with your Coast Guard, you know, we also want to be able to sort of get on board of these vessels and sort of see what's going on firsthand.
Is that what was happening with this really long chase that you describe in your story?
So in 2015, there was this chase of the Thunder, which was done by Sea Shepherd Global. And this was actually the longest nautical chase in history. It spanned 110 days and 10,000 miles. Now, this wasn't a scientific chase. This was Sea Shepherd Global basically trying to chase down and deter a large illegal fishing vessel. But they were only able to do this because they had agreements with a lot of countries and Interpol that sort of allowed them to coordinate this effort. And this really was a big turning point for the Sea Shepherd movement as a whole, because it really showed them that, look, if we work with other governments, if we work with international agencies, we actually might be able to accomplish a lot more of our conservation goals than we were able to in the past.
Okay, so now we're talking about this shift to science. What kind of research or data taking has been done so far on this fleet?
This is still early days for Sea Shepherd Conservation Society being a scientific organization. They have worked with scientists already for a few years. They have scientists in Mexico that are studying the vaquita, which is this really endangered porpoise. It's actually the ocean's most endangered marine mammal. They're studying how many are actually left and what kind of gears are they sort of getting caught in. They have scientists studying beaked whales off of Mexico. And this is a very elusive group of animals. We don't really know much about their behavior or birthing patterns or anything like that.
Yeah, you actually open with the vaquita researchers kind of facing some conflicts during their science mission.
And yeah, that's another thing Sea Shepherd brings to the table potentially, is this ability to, or even willingness to sort of go into potentially dangerous waters. And part of that is with studies of the vaquita, where they go in the northern Gulf of Mexico, they've actually encountered a lot of resistance from locals, because in the past, these shepherd ships had sort of yanked up these large nets from the waters that can ensnare vaquitas. But the fishermen rely on those nets for fishing and also catching this really valuable fish called the totoaba, which has this swim bladder that's very valued in Chinese cuisine and medicine. And so, you know, a lot of money can be made off of that. So there's not a lot of love lost between the locals and Sea Shepherd in some of these regions, especially given Sea Shepherd's past activities. But it's good for scientists because they can get into these regions where potentially other ships are not going to go.
Mm-hmm. Is the Sea Shepherd organization looking for more research to do? Do they have the capacity to host more kinds of data gathering operations?
Well, that's their plan, you know, going forward. This is an organization that the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society brings in and spends about $20 million a year. And they really do want to spend a chunk of this on science. That could include adding more ships, adding more equipment to its ships. And also, they want to bring in more scientists. They really want to put the word out that, hey, we've got these ships out there. We want you to apply for projects with us. And they're hoping to be working with potentially hundreds of scientists in the next 5 years from all over the world, especially places in developing countries where it's especially hard for scientists in these countries to even get on a ship in the first place, let alone try to do good science on these vessels. And they really, what they say, what Sea Shepherd says, they really want to make more of these opportunities available.
Is there a concern that their history or their conservationist bent might influence the kind of science that people do using these ships?
Yeah, well, some experts I talked to, you know, are concerned, you know, this used to be kind of a militant organization. This organization certainly has an angle, it has a conservation angle. So you always have to be skeptical when those types of organizations start collecting data. But, you know, the goal for them is to have independent scientists on board, to have an independent scientific advisory board. And so they are sort of doing all the things that they should be doing to be as impartial as possible. And they have said that we plan to be transparent with whatever data we collect, even if that data contradicts what we're saying. So if we say, like, you know, all these fish are disappearing in this area, or at least that's our stance, and the science shows otherwise, at least according to them, at least according to Singh, you know, we'd be happy with that, because, you know, that would show that maybe we don't have to focus our attention on this area, that maybe we should focus our attention elsewhere.
You actually deal with a lot of these organizations that have kind of a more extreme view, and they're trying to push things and make the world better, but not everyone agrees with their methods. Does this turnaround feel real to you? I mean, I'm thinking about all the other groups that you have contact with. How does this fit in with that?
It's always hard to tell, right? This is early days. This is a relatively recent sea change, if you will, for this group. It remains to be seen whether they can actually accomplish what they want to accomplish and whether they can actually balance their scientific goals with their conservation goals. A lot of their money comes in from people who want to save the whales and want to see them being really active and aggressive on the seas. And it's not, these millions of dollars in donations are not necessarily coming in because people want scientists on these ships measuring salinity levels. So I think that's going to be a big challenge for the organization going forward, is whether they can balance these two goals that they now have.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks so much, Sarah.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science and author of the book Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. Stay tuned for a discussion of the massive impact of the Tonga eruption on the planet, including global tsunamis. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Science Careers. Change your job and you might just change the world. For anyone who's looking to get ahead in or just plain get into science, there's no better, more trusted resource than Science Careers, and it's free. On our site, you can search career opportunities across all disciplines and levels, research potential employers, sign up to get job alerts via email, upload your resume or CV to the searchable database, or read career advice articles. There's no shortage of global problems today that science can't solve. Be part of the solution. Visit sciencecareers.org today.
On January 15, 2022, the eruption of a volcano in Tonga produced the biggest explosion in the atmosphere in modern history. In this week's issue of Science, two papers dig into how the eruption impacted Earth's atmosphere and oceans. I'm Megan Cantwell here with Emily Brodsky, who touches on both these papers and the broader implications of the results from the Tonga eruption in a science perspective. Thanks so much for joining me, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
So could you start with describing exactly the scale and size of this eruption?
So this volcano, Hunga Tonga Hunga Haya Pai, produced this enormous eruption. It produced the largest plume we've seen in modern history since we've been able to measure how high plumes go and how big they are. It's notable in part because that volcano was underwater. We don't normally think about underwater eruptions as so catastrophically explosive. And this blew the lid off, quite literally. It produced waves that wrapped around the Earth, both in the atmosphere and in the ocean, and actually in the solid Earth as well.
Some of the waves that traveled around the world were tsunamis, which appeared in every major water basin. Tsunamis most commonly result from earthquakes, but really any large displacement of water can produce them. Do the characteristics of a tsunami differ depending on the source?
Most tsunamis are made by just moving a whole lot of seafloor, so it doesn't really matter if the tsunami is made by an earthquake or a landslide. But in the case of Tonga, there really was something quite a bit different about how these tsunamis were made. And that's because in addition to moving the seafloor, the eruption also pummeled the atmosphere. And that wave moving through the atmosphere effectively blew the tsunami across the ocean, and it blew it very quickly. And they also did this crazy thing where they hopped over the land. So you would have them in one ocean basin, and then you would see them in the next ocean basin. And regular tsunamis don't do that. They need to keep going through the water. What's happening is because the atmosphere is continuous, it can keep going all the way around the world, even if there are land barriers in the way.
Yeah, and I mean, usually following an earthquake, there's a bit of a prediction or modeling forecasting that anticipates exactly what the impact will be. So following the Tonga eruption, was there a sort of estimate from researchers as to what they were anticipating was going to happen?
Yeah. So since the devastating Indian Ocean earthquake and accompanying tsunami and the Japanese tsunami in 2011, there's been quite a significant investment in being able to accurately forecast the timing and amplitude of tsunamis. And they're pretty good. They're good at what they do. This tsunami came in early, very early. And that's because the process by which these models work basically considers the ocean only. And so didn't consider this possibility that something in the atmosphere could interact at the air-sea interface and push it a lot faster.
Did this result in some areas not being warned that something was incoming? Did it have actual impacts on people's lives that this forecasting was off?
Fortunately, that initial very fast tsunami was actually pretty small. It caused damage in various places, but it wasn't catastrophic in the same sense as, say, the Japanese or Indian Ocean tsunami. In this case, it has more to do with realizing a gap in our knowledge and understanding that it has to do with the direct consequences.
There have been other volcanic eruptions in modern history. Is the gap in our understanding because none of them were large enough to produce this impact on the atmosphere?
Yes, it needs to be pretty big in the atmosphere to make this effect. In fact, it probably happened during Krakatoa. Krakatoa was 1883, though, so that's a long time ago. And the data really wasn't anything like the quality we have today. Press and Harkrider 50, 60 years ago had sort of thought that there might be this sort of funny coupling effect. And they had done quite a bit of analysis on it. But when you look at the data they were relying on, it was really a handful of tide gauges. It turns out, I think they were probably right, but it was hard to make a really strong case until you had modern data like we have today.
I mean, the network of instruments we have today is pretty staggering, right? I mean, what all was collecting data after this eruption?
So there is the global network of seismometers that measure the waves in the ground. There is a global network of infrasound instruments. Infrasound is long period, low frequency sound waves. So those are effectively microphones around the world. There were tide gauges around the world that measured the level of the water. And then there were other sorts of instruments. There were satellite measurements of the total electron content in the ionosphere. The ionosphere also moved up and down and had a wave propagating on it. The eruption was that big that it was able to connect and couple to the ionosphere. And so that combined data set is remarkable.
Yeah, and that's what one of the papers published this week is about. I mean, what exactly did they find? This data set is so rich. Were there any big surprises that came out of it?
I think just the pervasiveness, the speed, the complexity of the wave source, that was the big surprise from the network data. But I think it's going to take a long time until we fully understand what it means about the eruptive dynamics.
And some of these waves even circled the world multiple times, right? That's just how powerful it was.
Absolutely.
That's pretty crazy. And it was really interesting to see just how many, I mean, it makes sense, but there were a lot of authors on this paper and all of these different monitoring stations are set up around the world. I mean, is it pretty common following these major seismic or eruptive events that there's a lot of an international collaboration?
My seismometer by itself is really not very much good. I need to get together with all my other seismologist colleagues. The international network is what makes it possible. A lot of this infrastructure was put in place for the purpose of monitoring nuclear tests. And so it is controlled and operated by a variety of different enterprises and nations and local authorities. So there's a pretty well-developed network of collaboration and culture of collaboration so that we can, in fact, take a global view of problems.
With nuclear tests, there's a lot more limitations, right, in terms of making the data kind of publicly accessible. So I feel like this is a pretty unique opportunity to have all of these different monitoring stations picking up on something, right?
Yes, I think that's right.
Are there other ways that researchers can use these seismic signals to better understand processes that are happening on the surface of the Earth?
Absolutely. There's been a growth in what's known as environmental seismology recently, and that is using seismology and also infrasound to study surficial processes such as rivers, bed load transport, and coastal erosion, and glaciers, and hurricanes. All of those things pound on the ground with some amount of force. And we can use those forces and the seismic waves they produce to actually say something about each of those processes.
I'm excited to see all the stuff that comes after this. Thank you so much, Emily.
Thank you.
Emily Brodsky is a professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at the University of California, Santa Cruz. You can find a link to her perspective and the two papers we discussed at science.org/podcast.
And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. You can listen to the show on the Science website at science.org/podcast or search for Science Magazine on any podcasting app. This show was edited and produced by Sarah Crespi and Megan Cantwell with production help from Podigy. Special thanks to our summer intern, Tafia Chowdhury. Transcripts are by Scribby. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.